morning cues, it's so much fun.
Welcome into show notes, everybody. First off, happy anniversary to the Unfuckers at All group, 850 members strong over there on Facebook. And it's got new cover art from Dan Garcia to mark the occasion. Happy anniversary, everybody. Shouts to Bob Knutson, whose campaign for office is underway in Wisco. To Holdfast, our resident band and group of badass Celtic punk motherfuckers. To all the Uncanuckers, Eurofuckers, Down Under fuckers, Kiwi fuckers, Pitch, Pack, Bottle fuckers, we see you. To Ben Burgess and Brianna Joy Gray for coming on the show. To Jeremy Scahill and Amy Goodman for being principled and fierce. To 101, who's convalescing from her injury with her loving sister 99 at her side. To the great Manny Faces, who just had Jamal Bowman on his hip-hop show. To all of you doing the work each and every day, raising kids, sheltering animals, planting vegetables. To the nurses in hospice, the auto workers on the line, farmhands, stagehands, fast food workers, nursery school teachers, to progressive fighters who work themselves to the bone to fight for a better life for those around them. Not you, Republicans. You can suck a fat one. Not you either, Democrats. I'm talking about progressives. This is Unfucking the Republic. We're a bunch of well-intentioned leftists calling out bullshit when we see it and calling out Milton Friedman all the time. Hashtag FMF.
Say it loud, say it with me. Yo, fuck Milton Friedman.
We have a podcast, a YouTube channel, two newsletters, a monthly hang, a Facebook group, and the best website in the history of the internet. UNFTR.com. Go there. Learn. Become a member. Support our cause. Unfuck the Republic, why don't you? I'm solo today while 99's away, so let's drip the light fantastic. Drop some plastic on the wheels of steel and drive high in drive time. It's time for show notes. Let's get into some feedback. All right. Right up top, I'm putting my two Latina queens, Maria from Puerto Rico and Elena S. from Mexico. Because we got the episode about Puerto Rico and statehood, which... kind of mixed feedback on that one, which is kind of interesting. And then, of course, part one of Over the Borderline, our border crisis series. So let's start with Maria from Puerto Rico. I listened to the PR Statehood Phone-A-Friend episode with that pro-statehood guy and appreciate and thank Max for it. I really appreciate you seeing us in PR and devoting a whole UNFTR episode to us. The guy stated facts about PR, although he glossed over the PNP, his pro-statehood party is having, quote, issues, i.e. historical massive corruption, and that said party is very right-wing, backed by fundamentalist Christians here who are very powerful lobby, of whom all politicians in the traditional main two parties are terrified. It's anti-gay, anti-woman, anti-abortion, anti-reproductive rights, assimilist, more pro-US than pro-PR. You see where I'm going with this? It's very hard to identify with the pro-statehood people. The cliche that local PNP and PPD politicians, those are the two main parties, love, that we Puerto Ricans treasure our U.S. citizenship, is only partly true. We don't have any other citizenship, and we could easily be as stateless people as are the Palestinian people. By the way, listening to your pro-statehood friend accurately describe our PR historical facts and situation was chilling. I realized we have so much in common with Palestinians, although suffering infinitely less violence, in the present at least. Maybe that's why I have the Palestinian cause so deep in my heart and mind. We are the same. Those are my people. As are the Irish, the Haitians, and all colonized peoples. Same situation, although lesser in degree, of course. I don't ever want to minimize the horror of Palestinian history and present horrors. I read Khalidi cover to cover, and I'm reading Pape right now, and grow ever more indignant and frustrated. It's historically one of the biggest injustices, and I can't accept it. A couple of things here. Remember when we talked about how there was a growing sentiment, certainly among Arab and Muslim voters in the country, even if they were aligned with the Democratic Party, but among the, let's just say, younger African-American voters and black voters in this country that had alignment with the Palestinian cause because they recognized themselves in that cause, and how that was going to blow back on the Democratic Party. I think anybody that has a history of marginalization and being othered and being suppressed and oppressed sees this conflict for what it is, and that's why the Democratic Party is having such a hard time getting their arms around this. They just don't fucking get it. So I appreciate you calling that out, Maria. The other thing is, this Puerto Rico statehood dropped in my lap. We had actually, if you remember, the interview had dropped into my lap, and I took it because we have done some work on U.S. foreign policy in the Caribbean, specifically when we talked about Haiti, we talked about the Dominican Republic, talked about Puerto Rico and Cuba. We never got into Grenada, the Virgin Islands, or any of those, but we talked about those islands specifically in the Washington Consensus episodes, and we've done some other things related to the LAC territories, Latin America and the Caribbean. So I wanted to pick back up on the Puerto Rico conversation because, again, the interview had dropped in my lap. And also there is this pending legislation that had made it a little bit further than it had historically. My bad for not prepping a little bit more on the alignment of the statehood party with what the powers that be in the elite class within Puerto Rico really want. Doesn't mean that the argument for statehood is thrown out the window, but it's really good to know who's backing it and what the ruling class of Puerto Rico gets out of it as opposed to just the citizens of Puerto Rico. And I should have known more about that before I did the interview. Having said that, that's why we do this. And we were at least able to bring forward the independence argument, which is the one that I'm much more familiar with, rather than the statehood argument. So on a surface level, I understood it, that why the statehood argument wasn't getting traction while we had a mixed Congress or certainly a Republican Congress, because the assumption is that the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote in Puerto Rico will go as most of the Latino vote outside of the Cuban vote in this country goes, which is predominantly Democratic, but that's not a given. And I think that George was right to point that out, that, you know what, not really a given. Having said that, I think that it is on balance more true than not that they would vote Democrat, and that it's very likely that we would pick up two Democrats in the Senate that represented Puerto Rico. And obviously that's why the Republicans have historically been against it. So there is that. And I am more familiar with the independence movement because I remember the Newsbeat crew interviewing Rosa Clemente and a few others that had been agitating for that. And that's why we knew the history of the dehumanizing history of mass forced sterilizations and incredibly corrupt colonialist policies. I still do take George's argument that there is still a kinship and a natural kinship now that so many years have gone by. I mean, it's 100 years. I don't want to call it assimilation because I think that one of the things that the Puerto Rican people have done, at least in New York, is really maintain their identity and their heritage. And if anything, they've actually infused New York with a cultural sense and sensibility that is still very, very culturally dominant. So I don't see the assimilation so much as I see that they have actually enhanced and brought their culture into ours, and it has improved everything. So that being said, I'm really glad, and that I wanted to surface Maria's comments sooner because it's important to get the perspective of core listeners who understand where we're coming from, what we're shooting for, but really have some boots on the ground. With that in mind, let's go to just below the border, to Elena S., who said, there will never be enough border security to satisfy the Republicans, without mentioning some asshole Democrats who follow their lead, because the whole problem is based on white supremacy. If there's a crisis, it's more of a problem for Mexico than for the United States, but some want to blame everything on Mexico. Immigration is also a problem for us because hundreds of thousands of immigrants are passing through our country and become trapped at the border. It's a very good point. The solutions to the border problem are self-evident, but that's of no concern to mostly Republicans because they have nothing else to offer. One might wonder why so few Mexicans are going to the United States nowadays and so many more are coming here. The reason is because we now have a government that responds to the needs of the people. When the U.S. imposed neoliberalism on us, our agriculture was shot to hell. Small farmers no longer were subsidized and felt it necessary to immigrate to the U.S. They sold their land to realtors for less than what it was worth. The realtors divided it into small lots to create working-class barrios, or sold the land to companies like Monsanto to create huge haciendas where they could destroy the land with all their environmentally poisonous chemicals. We were told it would be cheaper to buy our produce from the United States, But during AMLO's administration, we've been trying to go back to producing for ourselves. There's a lot more to Elena's comments, but I thought that just that her opening salvo here was great to position us to talk about the next step of the border crisis series. So this weekend, we're actually doing, I'm sort of interrupting the series to do a different episode, which we'll talk about in a minute. But when we resume the border crisis series, we're going to be talking specifically about what is happening below the border. And what the Latin American economies and South American economies specifically are contending with, and the political structures are contending with, that are leading to this migration crisis that is coming through Mexico. And then we should probably spend some time just in Mexico. That may have to be a separate episode. But for right now, the way I have it planned out is that it's going to be two episodes about South America, one from a political standpoint and one from an economic standpoint, and then maybe we'll append something specifically about Mexico. But I thought it was important to surface Elena's comments because she, again, is a core unfucker and has the context and the boots on the ground. Now over to Noah J. Noah commented on two phone-a-friends that we have here. He said, "You've done some fantastic phone friends, and these are two of the best so far. As I listened to Breonna Joy Gray discuss the lack of action by our representatives on popular policy, and George Laws Garcia call out egregious missteps with Puerto Rico, I kept thinking about the principal reason we seceded from England. No taxation without representation. I've oversimplified things by being too productive before, and maybe right now. I wonder if there's a play to withhold paying taxes until our government reflects the populist policies. I know this would be a huge battle and a long game. Or is the complexity in that we just elected these people and we need to vote them out if we aren't happy? We're just repeating the cycle of being disappointed by another candidate who never delivers. And frankly, why isn't it that simple for Puerto Rico? Or am I being too reductive?" So interesting, a movement not to pay taxes would be powerful. It's not something I've thought a great deal about. It is... So one of the reasons that it would be difficult and dangerous to pull off for people is the financial system has tethered us to certain financial indicators and markers that affect the rest of our lives. And what I mean by that is, let's say you don't pay your taxes. Well, the bureaucratic process is such that you will be in arrears and you will have the government chasing you, and then prohibiting you from other really important actions, your mortgage, your car payments, your student debt payments. They all become tied to and subordinate to whatever you wind up owing the government. So even if you're holding this in abeyance, they can come get it. Even if you decide is a part of a mass protest, that protest would have to quite literally bring the government to a halt. There would have to be tens of millions of people that were protesting through the withholding tax payments, that it would then sort of affect change in some sort of coordinated way where there was an ask. So it's not just enough to say, stop fucking everything up or I'm never going to pay my taxes. You would have to have a specific ask. It would have to be, I want a ceasefire in Palestine. I want to stop selling weapons to the state of Israel to kill innocent Palestinians with. And there's literally 70 million people here that are going to withhold taxes until that happens. Or we want Medicare for all. We're not giving you another dime in taxes until you actually make this happen. Stuff like that. It would have to be really, really specific, and it would have to be monumentally coordinated, which makes it really wholly impractical. I think the best advocacy and the best activism on major issues is to disrupt the power base. Make them uncomfortable with where they live. And you see that activists are making that happen right now by literally disrupting. Every time a politician goes to open their mouth, there's somebody there to yell and disrupt for a free Palestine. That's really effective. And that does wear them down over time. Activism for policy. This is where we're going to talk a little bit this weekend in the episode Project 2025. We're completely dissecting the conservative playbook to hijack the presidency and the Congress come 2025, because their assumption is that they're going to win the election. And they've created a blueprint and a playbook. It's a 900-page blueprint, by the way. This isn't like a policy statement or a brochure or guiding principles. It's a 900-page playbook. It's the culmination of 50 years of conservative activism to upend social and cultural norms and gains in this country. That's what we're fighting against. And it's why when we have small protests or small even, you know, uprisings or movements and even, you know, giant parades and whatever it is, right? It pales in comparison to the long, drawn out, coordinated, complex coup that the conservative movement has been able to carry out. So much like the Fabians in England, who were the socialists in the bureaucratic apparatus that churned away policy and churned over time to get things like universal health care in the UK before it was fashionable, to fight for the strength of the unions and the working class and the pay and benefits and social services. That was done by socialists who were quietly, assiduously advocating from inside the system. We need all of it. But to put yourself at risk, to withhold paying your taxes, the bureaucratic apparatus as it stands today would fuck your life up so much that it's not something I could possibly advocate for anybody. Moving to Caesar. The other day, I made a new friend who recommended to check out Unfucking the Republic. When I visited the podcast channel, it turned out that the most recent episode was about Puerto Rico statehood. I'm Puerto Rican. As soon as I saw the guest belonged to the pro-statehood party, I had an idea of how he would frame things, and I was not disappointed. He avoided calling PR a colony until the host did so. Hey, that's me. He mentioned that 95% of the island supports statehood, but never mentioned that such percentage comes from the last plebiscite about statehood in which most people decided not to vote as an act of rejection toward, I think, what was the sixth plebiscite. What the percentage shows is that 95% of a small number of people who went to vote support the pro-statehood political party. Elections and plebiscites are holidays in Puerto Rico. I know a lot of people that just went to the beach that day, and I predicted an argument would be made about how much better PR had it once the U.S. invaded, but not a word about how Spain was already in the process of accepting to give PR a lot more freedom. So again, in really important context, he does close out by saying, I appreciate you talking about this subject. I can see why my friend recommended your podcast. Have a great day. Well, Caesar, I hope you are continuing to stay with the podcast and you're with us. And I just wanted to say thank you for sending in such a thoughtful note. It really helps contextualize what we heard. Dan H. said, hey, UNFTR crew, great episode as always. I really like the format of part traditional episode and part phone a friend to fill in the real world experience. I do too. I wonder, do others? I'd like to hear from you if that's the case. Dan H., I appreciate that feedback. Two questions for you. One, I appreciate Marlene's perspective on the issue and her clear understanding of the complex bureaucracy for migrants in New York. However, many of their proposed solutions feel small and targeted by design, I imagine, so they're more accomplishable. I'm curious, in your conversations and research for the series, there are also big ideas people are pursuing, like what if migrants were sent to areas of the country that have seen population loss in recent decades, like Detroit, and in exchange for housing and employment opportunities, the government garnishes X percent of their wages to pay for the plan over time. If we're having to triage the situations of more people than live in a state like Wyoming, I feel we need a bigger picture plan than defending against bad policies and streamlining processes on the margins. And number two, unrelated, I'm looking for a new podcast app. Any suggestions? I don't use it enough to pay for something. I just need something to keep the few shows I have organized and auto-downloaded. Yeah, I used Pocket Cast, and I think 99 does as well. Manny, you want to weigh in here on some that you like?
Yeah, Pocket Casts, people like that. There was Podcast Addict. I don't know if it's still around. And I use CastBox, which is an Android app. Maybe it's both. I don't know. I spend surprisingly little time listening to podcasts, as I spend all of my time making them. So, I don't know, whatever works for you. Try them out. You know, most of those should have sort of the auto download and all the, you know, basic stuff. I like CastBox, but I kind of want to get their pro version so I don't get the little ads, but they're on a subscription as opposed to just a straight buy, and I don't like that. So, I just use it to keep track of things. It's pretty good. But, you know, whatever floats your podcasty boat.
In reference to the first question, migrant populations historically go to places that have growing populations for that very reason, because that's where the work is. I think it would be backwards to try and subsidize places that are having population loss just to send them to a place that has population loss because the jobs are leaving. So states, municipalities, with coordination from the federal government, need to do a better job at economic development in certain regions. And there's various approaches to that. And we can talk another time about the best approaches that have the best roots that avoid things like, you know, gentrification and, you know, the impact to affordable housing, which is typically what happens when an area that is not ready for an influx gets too big too fast, gets overbuilt, gets gentrified, affordable housing goes away, people have to leave, and it's kind of a vicious cycle. But to suggest that we just reroute migrants into a territory where there are no jobs would obviously would have its own problems, and then they would become, they'd wind up becoming wards of the state, essentially, and then it would play into the hands of people that are, you know, the Republicans and the conservatives that say, oh, these people are just here to, you know, suck off the government teat, even though they're not. So remember, when migrants come to the country, they go to the places where there's work, first off and foremost, right? And even if they are undocumented, they are in the system to the extent where they are they're helping economic development. How? Because they're renting out areas, places that are available. So when they give their rent to the landlord can more easily pay their taxes, right? And their mortgage and all those things. So they participate in that way. They buy stuff. They buy cars. They have to fix cars. They put gas in cars. They put oil in their cars. They go to the store and they buy food and they contribute to the general economy and things lift. I live in an area that has almost, I want to say, oh man, at this point it's probably predominantly Hispanic. Huge influx of migrants and, you know, both undocumented and totally legal pathways to citizenship that came into the area that I live. I've noticed that, you know, some people are like, ooh, you live there? Because there's like a lot of signs in Spanish and there's people speaking Spanish all over the place. And there's bodegas, and we have all these like specialty supermarkets and from that have food from all over the world. It's fucking amazing. Personally, I think it's awesome. And people are like, oh, you live over there? And I'm like, yeah, what's the problem? They're like, oh, well, I live in this other area. And I'm like, yeah, we don't have any storefronts available. Like all of our retails, you might not like the fact that the sign's in Spanish, but it's rented. Like I'd rather have people contributing to the economy knowing that their kids are going to come up and matriculate through the school systems and they're going to do all the things that we have, you know, the full promise and expression of immigration and citizenship in this country because their parents worked hard to get here. Even if they cut corners and broke some rules to get here, they're playing more by the rules than a lot of people that were born here. So we know that there's economic development. We know that they play by the rules more so than native-born citizens who are a little more entitled to citizenship than people who come here that are afraid of getting in trouble. Their second generation winds up being the entrepreneurs, the ones that are the true engines of the economy, and they're building things up. The people that are undocumented are paying into the Social Security system if they get an illegal number, and they're never going to see the benefits from it. And all the while, they're actually helping the community that they live in do better. So I wouldn't want to stop people from migrating to places where there's a clear need for economic development. And the only reason that they're coming there to find work is because there's work available. So anyway, that's how I feel about that. It's a great question. Just flip it on its head and follow it to its logical conclusion. And I think that makes more sense. James Q said, yeah, 25 minutes was enough to remind me why I chose long ago not to listen to Brianna Joy Gray's podcast. She's unquestionably brilliant, and she engages in constant criticism. 25 minutes, and I have yet to hear any balance. To be clear, I'm not saying there aren't valid critiques to be made, but listening to her, it seems that everyone's corrupt, and there's no one good on the inside. You need voices like Brianna to provide searing criticism and clarity on certain issues. Otherwise, we'll constantly be in a place of compromise. So that's how you identify the compromise, is when you speak really loudly on both sides of the issue. And you're speaking in an uncompromising way. And then you hopefully wind up with some sort of compromise that leans more towards your position than not. Now, I get that she's not everybody's cup of tea. And I hear and I feel what James Q is saying about Brianna's critiques. I happen to like them because they remind me of what a pure critique looks like from a very intellectual and studied perspective. There's nothing emotional about what she's bringing to bear. There's no She builds with facts. She calls things the way they are. And she argues for the most principled stance that one can have. And that's important. That's really important. So that's why I appreciate it. But I also appreciate what James Q is saying. And by this point, however many minutes into this thing that we are, I think it's time to take a little breath. Let's just get up and stretch for a second. Acknowledge how much better this always is when 99 is here. Because we'd be doing something silly right now. And it's hard for me to be silly by myself. I'm silly enough, believe me. But she gets me going and I get giggling. And anyway, I miss my friend. I wish she was here.
What? You're weird.
You're funny.
Okay.
Anyway, let's get back into it. Craig H. said, I'm a little late getting this email off, but had something to say regarding Breonna Joy Gray. When the phone a friend with her dropped, I finally went online to listen to her discussion with Crystal and Kyle. It was a good back and forth. Breonna made some great points. Her critiques of Biden and the left are insightful. But when Kyle mentioned election night and if it's Trump v. Biden again and he said, who do you want? Breonna said, I don't care. Really? Max, I'm 56. I'm married. I have 2 boys, 6 and 8. Do they get to grow up in a democracy? Over the years, I've lost a friend to addiction of OxyContin thanks to the sack of shit family and crony capitalism. My wife's good friend was killed in the Las Vegas shooting. Good Lord. Leaving very young children behind. My niece was supposed to be at the Borderline Bar in Thousand Oaks, California, where a mass shooter entered, but decided not to go at the last minute. We could have lost her. Oh, and another good friend of mine died of COVID. He wasn't vaccinated because enough vaccine disinformation was around, so he put it off, and it cost him his life. Last, my parents still have that fucking red hat hanging on the wall next to the crucifix. So am I traumatized? Fuck yeah. But I have 2 boys that I have to raise to fight for to make sure they survive fucking elementary school and have a country and a climate to grow up in. There's a lot riding on this election. I'm a fucking parent. I don't have the luxury of I don't care. Hoo-hoo! God damn! Ultimately, Craig H., that's where I land. And I'd love it if you listen this weekend to the Project 2025 episode. Because I land there, I think, with more clarity than I've even had up until this point. But let me be very, very clear. I get that the I don't care is the tipping point and the turning point. But the process, the uncompromising process where we ask for the things that are meaningful to us every step of the way and demand more from our politicians and our elected officials, and we protest and we yell and we scream and we fight, and we be uncompromising in our principles, even if we wind up with the compromise, we have to be principled in our approach. That fight up until Election Day, I've said before, Election Day is 1 minute. It's a moment. It's a second when you click the lever, fill in the box, do however you're doing this. And then your life goes on as it had before. A lot of things change and a lot of things don't. In this next election, a lot more could potentially change for new reasons, for different reasons than I've put out there before, which is why I'd like people to listen this weekend. But yeah, man, I feel you. You got 2 boys, I got 2 girls. And I think when you become a parent, hopefully when you become a parent, your mindset automatically shifts to what am I leaving them? It's not about you anymore. And I think about them and their circumstances. What they're going to do for a living, who they're going to fall in love with, where they're going to live, what's going to be left of this country by the time I'm gone, kind of place that they're going to be raising their children. Did I do the right things? Did I give them the right education? Did I give them everything that they needed to get along in the world? I don't know. You try not to impose your beliefs on them, but, you know, all you can do, I think, is live genuinely and show them what goodness looks like. You know, just modeling goodness. I've seen it all too often where you try to force, you know, your perspectives down a kid's throat and they just wind up going the other way with it. I mean, look at me. I mean, perspectives were never forced down my throat. I had a very open and loving house, but I grew up in a very Republican household. Started out as a Republican, ran for office as a Republican, and then started reading. And then I went the other way. But yeah, no, what we leave our kids is just... I'm obsessed with the idea. So I feel every letter of your email, Craig, and appreciate you saying it. And at the same time, I know it's not fashionable to quote Mel Gibson movies anymore. And I probably said this one before, but If you remember in Braveheart, Robert the Bruce's dad says to him, he's that old guy who's got the, what do you call that when you're, oh, he's got leprosy, right? And he's got shit, his face is like falling apart and whatever. And he says to his son, Robert the Bruce, uncompromising men are easy to admire, but it is exactly our ability to compromise that makes us noble. And I don't know why that stuck with me, because it's like, yeah, Robert the Bruce at the end of the fucking movie comes out, and I know the movie doesn't have any historical basis in reality, but at the end of the movie, Robert the Bruce comes out, he's like, you bled with Wallace, now bleed with me. And they actually do it, and I'm like, fuck this guy. I don't think I would have done that, you know? I mean, he sold William Wallace fucking down the river.
Piss off, William Wallace.
What? What? I thought I heard him.
Piss off, William.
No, you piss off.
No, you piss off, William.
No, you first.
No, you. No, you.
You first.
No,
you piss off.
What?
What?
No, I just. I,
what is that? I didn't hear.
I can't hear you.
No, you
piss off, William Wallace. Jinx, you owe me a grog.
Anyway, but I remember it being like, you know, he finally had the nerve and the, you know, the nuts to throw caution to the wind and tell his father to go fuck himself and be uncompromising in that moment, in that final moment. That was sort of like the big point of the whole thing. Is that you don't have to compromise. You can reach your objectives. That being said, I don't think any of their independence. But I have a whole other story about actually being in a bar in Scotland past lockdown and arguing with a guy by throwing Braveheart quotes at him. It didn't end well for me. Nor should it have, but it amused the fuck out of me at the time. Anyway, so Braveheart, not really the great litmus test for any political discussion, but that idea of being uncompromising, that being exactly opposite of what nobility would do, is one of the reasons I think it drives people nuts and they just want to be like, fuck that, I want to be uncompromising. Be uncompromising in your principles, live that way, model that for your kids. But when it comes decision time, when you're left with only two decisions, you do have to make the practical choice here to fight for another day without, you know, burning the barn to get to the nails, as we say. Some general feedback here. Chris A. Hi, 99MX. I have two recommendations for activist resources or political organizations. Both are focused on reducing the influence of money in politics and reversing Citizens United. Represent.us and movetoamend.org. These two will make it into the directory and resources. I'm actually emailing myself right now to remind myself to do that. Resources. Send. Okay. So it's represent.us and movetoamend.org. Chris A., thank you for sending that in. Now we got back-to-back from two members of Hold Fast. First is from the captain. Just wrapped a rewatch of season one of The Tourist in preparation for season two. As I finished up, I wondered what other shows Max might be missing. I wrapped up season two of The Tourist. I finally finished it, by the way. And it was fine. It was fine. If they have a third season, I'm not sure I'm in for it. I think I'm good. Especially because I think I mentioned last week that my wife and, or maybe I mentioned it in the newsletter, that my wife and I started The Bear. And I am fucking obsessed. Partially, I think, because I spent 10 years in hospitality and I'm looking at this and I'm being like, God, this is really accurate. And the other piece of it is the dialogue. I don't know who the writers are. I haven't looked into it enough. And I know I'm super late to the game. Whoever's writing this fucking series is a genius, or it's a group of geniuses. Oh my God, the writing is so crisp. That being said, we definitely need more fucking. There needs to be more sex in The Bear. My wife disagrees. She's like, it's fine. Stop it. Why are you such a pervert? I'm like, because, you know, it just, there should be a lot more fucking. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, back to the captain. Let's start with my favorite Australian series, Mr. In Between. Excellently acted, brilliant dark humor, possibly my favorite show of all time. Bonus for fans of The Tourist, Damon Erriman has a prominent role in this series as well. That was terrible, I know. By the way, I love Mr. In Between, but only because I've watched a million clips of it on YouTube and I haven't watched it like sitting and watching it. I just like watching clips of people beat the shit out of people. in movie scenes, like really great action sequences. And what I love about Mr. In-Between is this guy's like incredibly unlikely, but also there's something about him where, because he's just like a sinewy type of guy, and you wouldn't look at him and be like, that guy could just fuck everybody up. But there's a look to him. He's got this something about this guy. So I love it. I'm in. Gangs of London, all the brutal violence you would expect from Gareth Evans, writer and director of the Raid film series. Oh, shit. I got to find that. And Guy Ritchie is back. He has a series that just came out, The Gentleman, and a new film coming out, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Give me a rock and roll a sequel. Damn it. I dig it. I am definitely going to watch The Gentleman, by the way. I'm all in. So great suggestions. The Captain. Oh, Captain, my Captain. And then his buddy Dave from Holdfast said, hope you're doing well. I have a book recommendation. I love these fucking guys. So great. The Captain's like, you should watch this Australian show where people get fucked up. And then Dave's like, oh, by the way, I have a book recommendation. Hammer by Hamilton Nolan. It just came out last month. It's an inspiring look. Can you imagine what their rehearsals are like? God, I would fucking love to be at a Holdfast rehearsal. Sorry. It's an inspiring look at opportunities, challenges, successes, failures, and leaders of the current labor movement. If any unfuckers are looking to convince their friends and families to support the labor movement in this country, they should start by sharing this book. I'd also be curious to hear Max's take on Hamno's assertion that increased union membership is a better tactic in the struggle to reclaim democracy in America than party politics. He argues that well-run unions' internal machinery provides an individual's only true experience with democracy of any kind, and that experience helps bind together individuals and communities in a way that politics never will. Ergo, a massive increase in union membership will create a formidable voter bloc that supports socialist policies and platforms. In any event, it is worth the read. That's really curious. Dave, that's a pretty layered question. I appreciate that, man. So I would go back to the fact, not even the notion, but the fact that the socialist movement and the union movements traditionally have not been very well aligned, except for some, few rare instances. I'm thinking France. Outside of that, the labor movement in the UK, much stronger than the socialist movement. In Germany, it was different, and they went very different paths. You saw unions were not as strong there. Of course, the unions, the real unions within Russia, the Soviets themselves, were the power base. And until they were corrupted and co-opted by the authoritarian, the Stalinist regime, they really did hold the keys to the kingdom. Here in the United States, it's interesting because when unions were at their most powerful, I would say, and check me on this, unfuckers, and give me some feedback here. I would say when they were at their most politically powerful was probably in the time that we were at our peak economically, coming out of the 50s and 60s. But again, you've got so many dynamics. So you have the racist elements that sidelined black workers in this country that were more actively participating coming into the 40s and into the war period. And then the racist structures of the union started to sideline the African-American union members in this country. So we have a whole other dynamic than most other places. In terms of alignment between socialism and unions, again, there has never been a time in this country where the socialist movement and the union movement actually worked together hand in hand. Because, again, the union movement, the socialist critique of the trade union movement primarily, is that it is, by definition, subordinating itself to the capitalist class. It's fighting for the scraps on the table instead of owning the table. Whereas the socialist movement says, fuck them, let's just own the table. We don't need them. We don't need their capital. The excess capital that is thrown off from anything that involves labor goes to the capitalist class and the finance class when they actually didn't do anything to put the labor in. So fuck them. Have a worker co-op structure. Let's just own the table. So there is some inherent tension between the two. That's why they were looking for a general union. They were looking for to get away from the craft unions and just have union membership where there was a workers' party, the IWW, looking to get all workers to have a massive rights to be able to stop the powers that be. So it's interesting. It is an interesting supposition to say, having greater union membership is a better pathway to change in this country. But it is change that reclaims some capitalist strength, but it does not change the dynamics of capitalism that ultimately wind up suppressing the masses and the classes. And I think that's a really important distinction to talk about. Overtaking the political apparatus is actually in our ability if we can message to the public with options and get money out of the system. Money in the system is the most inherently corrupting aspect of this system suppressing the masses. If money was out of the system and we had election reform and we had more parliamentary type processes to elect individuals and representatives, and money wasn't such a big fucking factor, especially with the power of social media today, we might actually have the ability to put people within the political apparatus and the governmental apparatus that can affect true, authentic change. So to me, money is the big evil. Getting more people to join unions. Remember, union membership in this country, I think, is down to around 11% now. And if you take New York out of the mix, by the way, I think that number is way lower. New York has the highest union density in the country. The other piece of the puzzle here, Dave, is that work has changed. Intellectual work, service work is very different today than the type of work that lent itself to trade unions in the past. So let me not say any more about it because you deserve to have me read the book and actually form an opinion based on what he's saying. But I think that the conversation that you're bringing up is one that we all should be having all the time. Where are the levers of power? How do we leverage those levers to affect change fast and change that sticks? Because, and I know I'm over-promoting the episode this weekend, when you hear what the Republicans have planned for us, there's a lot on the line because these are changes that would be etched and not just like the kind of executive order type things that can be reversed. Some of them are, but a lot of them aren't. These are ones that would kind of be etched into stone and it would take us decades to repeal them. And we don't have decades anymore. Anyway, fucking hold fast. Yeah. I wanted to end on those guys. A lot less silliness, probably a lot more meandering because I don't have my governor's cap on me right now. I don't have my buddy, my compadre sitting across from me being like, shut up. What are you doing? Stop talking. Move it along. Or actually injecting something interesting into the conversation. So
wait, should I tell people that B12 supplements make your pee neon yellow?
Sorry you had to listen to me for so long. Definitely check out this weekend's episode on Project 2025 from the Heritage Foundation, what the Republican blueprint is for the country if Trump is elected and they take over Congress. And even if Trump is just elected, there's a lot of shit he can do without Congress, by the way. And don't just buy into the hype of democracy is on the ballot, like that fucking hyperbole shit. We have a lot more to worry about than like whatever's left of our democracy being on the ballot, okay? There's like real shit that they're going to do to make people's lives fucking miserable. So pay attention to it. Check it out. Let me know what you think. On the flip side, we'll be back into the border crisis. And at some point in between, I am spending a couple of days traveling. I'll tell you all about it when I get back. Love you all, unfuckers. Miss you, 99. Manny, you're the GOAT. Catch you all.